Sleep is not an indulgence or a luxury. It's an essential part of our health, and indeed it defines our ability to function not only the next day, but also lifelong. There was a study on junior doctors showing that 57% of junior doctors had either had a crash or a near miss driving home after the night shift.
Professor Russell Foster, neuroscientist and sleep expert.
There's a condition called REM behavioral disorder where people are not paralyzed when they sleep. And so they can act out dreams and nightmares. And there have been several instances where somebody has murdered their bed partner. Risk-taking, this is a dangerous one, because, of course, you think, I can get through before the traffic lights change red. No, you can't. And you would never try it if you were fully rested. We see in night shift nurses high rates of breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and indeed the World Health Organization has designated night shift as a probable carcinogen. The tired brain remembers negative experiences but forgets the positive ones. So one's whole world view is influenced by one's negative recollections rather than the positive ones. But the one thing I would say that's so important, and I think it may be one of the most important, is that most people don't have a sleep issue or a sleep problem. It's
Hey there, friends. Welcome back to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. I'm here every Monday and Thursday talking health, wellness, and self-improvement with many of the world's leading experts. So if that is your thing, if that interests you, well then please like, subscribe, share with other people who you think might find interest in that sort of content too. And do leave the podcast a positive rating. We're almost 5 out of 5 now. So if you want to leave a rating, you can do so on iTunes and on Spotify. Incidentally, on Spotify, you can now watch these episodes too, as you can already do on YouTube. If you'd like to become a subscriber over on that platform too, that would be terrific. Now, I love any discussion on sleep, and today I'm joined with a world-renowned sleep expert. His name is Professor Russell Foster, and he's written a terrific book called Lifetime. In this interview, we talk about the rhythms of biology which govern our lives and our sleep, and we hear about how our body temperature, blood pressure, and hormones fluctuate throughout a 24-hour cycle, discover the importance of a chemical called adenosine, and how drinking coffee negatively affects its levels and, by extension, the quality of our sleep. We hear about the phases of sleep, sleep paralysis, and whether you should be using sleeping tablets at all. We also learn of the negative consequences physiologically and psychologically of even a couple of nights of bad sleep in a row. Plus, we hear about Professor Foster's research, which is hoping to help blind people and others restore regular sleep patterns. I love any discussion on sleep, as I said, and Professor Foster is an absolute joy to listen to. He's a mine of information. Now, just a heads up on this video, Professor Foster's webcam, for whatever reason, was only shooting in black and white, so don't adjust your settings. It's not a problem at your end. It was a problem with Professor Foster's camera. But never mind, the discussion itself and the content and the advice and the knowledge is jam-packed in there. So do enjoy this episode. Well, Professor Russell Foster, author of Lifetime, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today. At the start of your book, you lay out the importance of rhythms in human physiology. Can you explain what biological rhythms in the respect of sleep are and why they are so crucial to us? And then what's happening throughout that 24-hour cycle in regard to our body temperature, cortisol levels, and blood pressure, etc.
Sure. Well, I'm delighted to join you, Matthew. So if we step back and we think about what our biology does, it delivers the right stuff at the right concentration to the right tissues and organs at the right time of day. And it's the circadian system, this internal 24-hour sort of organizer that delivers this time structure for life. Why do we need it? Well, of course, we sit on a planet that revolves once every 24 hours. And I know it's stating the obvious, but of course, that produces profound changes in light and temperature And as a result, all life on Earth has evolved a response to those very different physical demands. So, you know, we see, of course, in ourselves, physical activity during the day, but then sleep at night. A lot's going on whilst we sleep, of course, but it's not physical activity. And so the metabolism underpinning those different states is fundamentally different. And so what we've got is a circadian system, which is fine-tuning our biology to the varied demands of the rest activity, the light-dark cycle. So in anticipation of waking up in the morning, before we wake, core body temperature is rising, blood pressure is rising, metabolic rate is rising, so that when we eventually get out of bed and we need to function, we need to be active, our biology can underpin that new demand, that new activity. And at the other end of the day, of course, we wind down our activity in preparation for sleep. And again, we undergo a lot of reversal of those sorts of processes that we've just talked about. So the circadian system gives us the time structure for life.
What, in this discussion then, what is the significance of adenosine to our ability to fall asleep? Ideally, this should be rising throughout the day and peaking just before bedtime.
Yeah, adenosine is really... So we've talked about the circadian system, and that time stamps everything about our sleep and our biology. But sleep has another timer, and it's perhaps the most intuitive part about sleep, which is the longer we've been awake, the greater the need for sleep. What happens is that sleep pressure builds up as we're awake. And one of the molecules that's been associated with that buildup of sleep pressure is adenosine. Now, the energy currency of all cells is ATP. And when that molecule is split to release energy, adenosine is part of the result. And so it's a very good marker of metabolic activity. So adenosine rises and rises and rises throughout the day. And it, in a sense, interacts with the circadian system, because we get sleepier and sleepier and sleepier. Why don't we fall asleep? And that's because the clock is saying, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake. And normally, if we've had enough sleep the night before, our adenosine levels aren't particularly high at the beginning of the day. So the circadian drive for wakefulness keeps up. But if we've not slept the night before, we already start with high levels of adenosine. And so the circadian system is scrabbling, you know, to try and keep up, to keep us awake, but often it doesn't. So we might fall asleep. But under normal circumstances, so we've got the adenosine levels rising, the circadian system stay awake, and then at some point towards, you know, bedtime, the circadian system will say, right, now's the time to go to sleep. The wakefulness drive will decrease. The sleepiness, the homeostatic drive, levels of adenosine will kick in and we'll fall asleep. Whilst we're asleep, the circadian system is saying, stay asleep, stay asleep, stay asleep. And then in the morning, it begins to kick in. The adenosine levels and the sleepiness drive, the homeostatic drive for sleep has diminished. And then, of course, we wake up in the morning. So there's a very interesting interaction between sleep pressure encoded by adenosine and the circadian system. And ideally, the two should work together. It's a real problem, though, if you think about night shift workers, because they are trying to sleep. They don't adapt to the demands of working at night. That's the first point. We can discuss why that is in a minute. And so they're trying to work while their whole biology is saying it's sleep time. So they leave the night shift. They go home. They are chronically tired. So the sleep pressure is really high. But the circadian system is saying, hang on, it's daytime. It's wake time. And so the circadian system will very rapidly override sleepiness drive. And so sleep during the day after the night shift is usually pretty short, on average 5 hours. And that, for most of us, is not enough.
It seems the world and its mother is drinking coffee at the moment. So we're talking about adenosine there. What's the relationship between adenosine and caffeine intake?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something we're actually working on. So caffeine will actually block the receptors in the brain that detect adenosine. So, you know, you've got your high levels of adenosine that will drive you into the sleep state, but those receptors, the brain can't detect that adenosine because those receptors have been blocked, at least for a short time, by caffeine in caffeinated drinks and things like coffee. So, yeah, that's why you genuinely feel more awake after a cup of coffee, because you've actually essentially masked that high sleep pressure by blocking the adenosine receptors.
Can we talk about the multiple phases of sleep whenever you do finally get to sleep, just to outline those for people again?
So sleep can be divided into non-REM, non-rapid eye movement sleep, and rapid eye movement sleep. And so a typical sort of 70 to 90 minute cycle that most of us will experience four or five times at night will be sort of quiet relaxation. The brain waves are sort of getting slightly bigger and slightly slower. And then we drop into stage one, two, and three, non-REM sleep. And then stage three is our deepest sleep, where the brainwave activity is large amplitude, slow rolling waves. And that's called deep sleep or slow wave sleep. Then we go very rapidly from deep sleep, bouncing through stage three, two, one, up into REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. It's an extraordinary stage of sleep because we're effectively paralyzed from the neck down. And if you ever looked at your partner, if you don't have a partner, well, maybe you've got a dog, and you'll actually see, you know, the dog can be twitching a little bit and you see those eyes moving. But it can't run around usually, but we can talk about a condition where you might run around. And it's during rapid eye movement sleep where we have our most sort of detailed, comprehensive and intensive dreams. And then we'll go from rapid eye, and it's from rapid eye movement sleep that we can wake up. And certainly in the morning, if you've slept naturally, you should ideally wake from REM sleep and not the alarm clock. You should just wake up naturally. But anyway, we've gone through that deep sleep, that non-REM sleep, into REM sleep. We drop back down into non-REM sleep, and we can do this four or five times a night. As I say, each cycle can take 70 to 90 minutes. You may wake up in the middle of the night from REM sleep. And that's nothing to worry about. It looks as though our ancestral sleep pattern, when we had more time to sleep, where our lives were not so pressurized and we were squeezing our sleep into this sort of much, much tighter time restricted. In the pre-industrial era, there were lots of records of I had a wonderful first sleep. And there were reports of this biphasic, i.e., going to sleep, waking up, going back to sleep again, waking up, or polyphasic, and waking up and going back to sleep again multiple times. And in a sense, that wake up is essentially correlated with that episode of REM sleep when we are most likely to wake up.
The sleep paralysis that you alluded to there, is that there in the first place in order to protect ourselves from acting out our dreams? Is that true?
Yeah, that does seem to be true, because there's a condition called REM behavioral disorder where people are not paralyzed when they sleep. And so they can act out dreams and nightmares. And there have been several instances, well-documented instances, where somebody has murdered their bed partner because they were acting out a dream. It's a famous case where a chap felt that somebody had broken in to the house and it was attacking him, and he killed his wife. I mean, mistook his wife for this person. And he was diagnosed with REM behavior disorder and was not then committed to prison. He was acquitted of murder. So, yeah, it seems to be extremely important. There are instances, incidentally, where the paralysis can keep going when you've woken up. And some people have had this, it's been described as an old hag sitting on your chest, because you're kind of aware, you're awake, but you're paralyzed and you can't get out of bed. And so that again, can be a slight mismatch with things that it tends to happen when people are very, very tired.
Wow, that sounds like a waking nightmare. Can I ask you?
Well, I think there's some wonderful old paintings of this depicting. You can see this sort of goblin-like thing sitting on the chest of this sleeper. Yeah,
I would rather not see them, to be honest. Ordinarily speaking, what happens to us from a cognitive standpoint and also physiologically elsewhere in the body when we suffer from a bad night's sleep, or indeed several in a row, as many parents of newborns would attest to?
Yeah, we should talk about newborns. It's a very interesting and special case, but we can divide the sort of impact of sleep loss into three different sort of sections. One is the impact on our emotions. The second would be the impact on our cognition, our ability to process information. And the third is with long-term chronic sleep deprivation, there are multiple impacts upon our physiology and our health. But let's start with the emotional responses. So we see a greater vulnerability, and this can kick in quite quickly. As you say, Matthew, 1 or 2 days, you know, you can see fluctuations in mood, increased irritability, anxiety, loss of empathy. It's really interesting. You fail to pick up the signals, you know, from others, and you fail to respond appropriately. That loss of empathy is so interesting. Frustration, risk-taking. This is a dangerous one, because, of course, you think, oh, right, I can get through before the traffic lights change red. No, you can't. And you would never try it if you were fully rested. But this increased risk-taking is quite serious. And particularly, you know, in industrial or indeed military situations. A very interesting work on negative salience. And what that means is the tired brain remembers negative experiences but forgets the positive ones. So one's whole world view is influenced by one's negative recollections rather than the positive ones. And we'll talk about mental health later, but there's an important link to mental health. If you're emotionally stressed out because you're tired, there's a tendency to try and overcompensate with caffeinated drinks, as we've talked about. And then, of course, you have wired yourself with caffeine. You then think, my goodness, I've got to get to sleep tonight. And then you resort to sleeping tablets or indeed alcohol. And they are sedatives. They don't provide a biological mimic for sleep. And that's so important. I mean, short-term use of sedatives, you know, to correct things, stabilize things, that's what your general practitioner will often prescribe. But it'll be a short-term use, not a long-term dependency. And of course, those sorts of stimulants can lead into illegal drug use, particularly by young people who are, you know, emotionally stressed and chronically tired. If we move now to our cognitive responses, our ability to process information, and I think this is so important. There was a lovely study by a scientist called Jan Born, who visited us just recently in Oxford. And he developed a problem-solving task. And he gave it to one group in the morning, and they had to solve that task in the afternoon. So he introduced the task to familiarize. They had to perform it that afternoon. And about 20% of the group solved the problem, so not a high success rate. Second group, introduced to the task in the morning, they performed it the following afternoon, but they were given no sleep. Again, about 20% solved the problem. So again, nicely accounting for fatigue. They weren't any worse because they weren't any worse than the day group. Of course, the third group, which is the most interesting, introduced to the task in the morning, performed it the following afternoon, but with a full night of sleep, 60 to 70% of the group solved the problem. And it's such a spectacular example of how sleep aids our ability to problem solve, come up with novel solutions to complex problems, which is such an important, you know, I think for people to issue for people to appreciate. Again, in terms of our cognition, our ability to multitask, we're bombarded with information, and normally we can say, okay, I'm going to do that and ignore some of the other stuff. If you're tired, it's so much more difficult to make those decisions about how you prioritize your actions. Communication skills, we've touched on creativity, productivity, and indeed our whole sense of social connectivity is very badly impaired as a result of just 1 or 2 nights of poor sleep. And then we move to the longer term, the sort of thing you'd find in night shift workers or people in the business sector or commercial sector who are getting very short nighttime sleep, certainly less than they would need. And so, of course, you get daytime sleepiness and the uncontrollable falling asleep, which can be really dangerous. And I think we may all sadly have experienced a microsleep from time to time where you just fall asleep uncontrollably. And if you're driving, of course, that's really dangerous, can be fatal. Incidentally, there was a study on junior doctors a few years ago showing that 57% of junior doctors had either had a crash or a near miss driving home after the night shift. I mean, it's really serious stuff. So that's in the sort of the things in terms of microsleeps, but you also see increased levels of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, for example, the need for antihypertensive medication. You see abnormal stress responses and also lowered immunity. This is what's so fascinating as well. Some interesting studies have shown that if you are sleep deprived immediately before or after a vaccination, let's say a flu vaccination, then your antibody response is significantly lower in response to that sleep deprivation. And it's probably associated with increased stress. And the one thing we know about high levels of cortisol, one of the stress hormones, is it will suppress the immune system. Another study in this area has shown that one night of no sleep has reduced the ability of natural killer cells. These are the cells that are involved, for example, in detecting and killing cancer cells by 27%. That's just one night of sleep, no sleep. And that lowered immunity has indeed been linked to cancer. So we see in night shift nurses, high rates of breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and indeed the World Health Organization has designated, because of these sorts of data, night shift as a probable carcinogen because of the higher rates in that group. We see metabolic abnormalities, obesity, type 2 diabetes, very common in night shift workers. And we get then to some really worrying areas such as depression and psychosis. We see higher rates of depression and psychosis in night shift workers. And indeed, very interestingly, individuals with depression and psychosis show poor sleep. We've done some studies here in Oxford showing that if you can improve the sleep of individuals showing who are on the sort of psychosis spectrum, they were showing paranoia and hallucinatory experiences, they had very bad sleep. If you could improve the sleep in those individuals, you actually reduce the levels of psychosis and hallucinatory experiences. And then finally, and this is, I know, rather depressing, but we'll get to some solutions. Dementia. So there's evidence, strong evidence, that very poor sleep during the middle years can increase your risk for dementia later on. Now, I'd never say that, you know, poor sleep in the middle years is going to cause dementia, but it's a risk factor. What's the mechanism? Well, over the past sort of decade or so, it's been shown that whilst we sleep, we actually package up and get rid of a misfolded protein called beta amyloid. And it's a buildup of beta amyloid within the brain that's been associated with dementia and Alzheimer's. And so it seems that that whilst we sleep, we get rid of that misfolded protein. And studies from the Netherlands have shown that one night of poor sleep actually increased detectably the levels of beta amyloid within the cerebral spinal fluid. And later experiments have shown that that is, it also prevents deposition within the brain. So, you know, essentially, sleep is not an indulgence or a luxury. It's an essential part of our health. And indeed, it defines our ability to function not only the next day, the Juno, but also lifelong.
Beautifully put, a really comprehensive answer. I think it actually touched upon a few of my questions. So if I could just talk then about the importance of the eye as far as our ability...
My favourite topic.
As far as our ability to sense time is concerned, because there are multiple receptors in the eye, but one in particular that gives us a sense of time. Could you talk us through that?
Yeah. So we've got this internal clock, but it's of absolutely no use at all unless it's set to the external world. And of course, the classic mismatch that many of us experience is jet lag. You know, we fly across multiple time zones, our body clock is telling us, you know, one thing, whereas we're expected to go out, socialize and function and all the rest of it. And we eventually get rid of jet lag as a result of aligning the internal clock to the external world. And that's exposure to the light-dark cycle. Now, the receptors in the eye, and this is something I've spent a long time working on. We started to look at this right in the late 80s and the early 90s were our first papers. We tried to work out how the eye detects that light. And of course, the obvious answer, and I'm sure lots of people are saying, duh, well, you know, it's the visual system, the visual cells, the rods and the cones. But we were working on some mice which had hereditary retinal disorders. And these mice were being used to study eye disease in humans. They were an interesting model. And so their visual cells had largely but not completely broken down. And so they were visually blind. Yet we put them in a pet shop running wheel, hooked it up to a computer, and we exposed these mice to a light-dark cycle. And they aligned their circadian behavior, their circadian rhythms, perfectly with a light-dark cycle. They were visually blind, but not clock blind. And then we began to think, well, crikey, maybe there's something else in the eye. And so I remember sharing these data fairly early on to a group of vision biologists in the States. And I was saying, you know, there's no functional rods and cones. You know, they're in training. Then it's not just that they can regulate and train their clock to the light-dark cycle. They do so with normal sensitivities. This is extraordinary. And I said, these data are therefore consistent with the fact that there may be an unrecognized light sensor within the eye. And this gentleman, who was fairly, you know, close to the front row, stood up and looked at me, and I thought, well, he's obviously going to ask a question. And so I sort of paused, and he looked at me and said, bullshit, and just walked out. I mean, it was fascinating, the ferocity with which that idea met with vision biologists. And, you know, the argument was, look, Foster, we've been looking at the eye seriously for 150 years. Are you seriously telling us we've missed an entire class of light-sensitive cell in the eye? Because I was young, full of vigor, I said, yes, on the basis of the data, that's what we've, you know, that's consistent. We had a problem, and I am happy to admit it. There were a reduced number of degenerate rods and cones in the eye. So the argument was, well, that's what's left. That's all you need to regulate the clock. So we then had to genetically engineer a mouse with no rods, no cones, all gone, and they regulated their clock by light perfectly normally. And that led to the discovery of a third class of a receptor within the eye. And it's called a photosensitive retinal ganglion cell. Now, the cells in the retina that form the optic nerve are the ganglion cells. They form these axons. And so this optic nerve is this massive, thick bundle of fibers from the eye. But what's so fascinating is about one in every 100 of those cells is directly light sensitive, using its own light sensitive molecule. So what we've got is we've got the eye as the organ of space because of vision, but also the organ of time because its ability to regulate the internal clock. And I've been privileged to work with Blind Veterans UK and talk to individuals who lost their eyes. And it's really poignant because I talked to one chap and he was saying, you know, I've lost my eyes, I can't see, but you know, I'm gonna deal with this. And so he was determined that he was not going to have the messy front garden. So he'd worked a way to get out the mowing machine and he'd worked out how to mow the lawn, although he was completely blind. And anyway, he was doing this on one occasion and his wife came down and tapped him on the shoulder and said, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. The neighbors are complaining. And of course, that illustrates the fact that you're time blind. The clock is ticking and you're drifting through time. Most of us, the clock is slightly longer than 24 hours. So you get up later and later and later, not by much. 15, 20, half an hour, minute, something like that. But you'll get up later and later. So sometimes you're aligned with everybody else and then you start to drift off. And this poor chap had woken up, thought it was daytime. And so they, oh, I'll make an early start, get the lawn cut. And of course, it was 3 o'clock in the morning and completely the wrong time. Now, what we've gone on to do most recently, and I think this is really exciting, is that we now know how those photosensitive retinal ganglion cells are interacting with the molecular clock. And so we've got drugs now that can fool the clock that it's seen light. So we've done all the mouse studies. We can actually put a mouse in complete darkness, give it this drug every day, and it will lock on thinking it's seen light. We've done all that. We know what the doses are. We've done the first in human trials to show that this drug is safe. And now we're developing funding to go for our full-blown clinical trials. And my hope is that I will be able to end my career by giving back a sense of time to the time blind. And it's not just people who've lost their eyes. Individuals with neurodevelopmental conditions, such as many children, for example, and their rhythms are smashed. In severe dementia, again, the sleep-wake cycle is completely disrupted. And in many forms of mental health, I've studied schizophrenia, the sleep-wake patterns are absolutely smashed. So in addition to the profoundly blind, we're hoping this drug will be able to, one of these drugs that we're working on, will be able to stabilize sleep-wake in these other clinical populations. That's my hope. And on the basis of the mouse data, and we are very like mice, I have to tell you, it looks extremely exciting.
Okay, so just to recap then, in the absence of light, if you put somebody away into a dark room for weeks on end, what would happen is that their sleep-wake cycle would move ahead, it would drift by 15, 20 minutes every single day, whereas yep. What you're suggesting is with your knowledge now of this this receptor in the eye and using these new therapies, these drug therapies, you can stabilize that yes. drift such that it does not happen. And this is yeah. then is useful then in lots of different situations that you just mentioned.
Yeah, exactly, Matthew. And really, that's it's so exciting because we can use, you know, this is fundamental curiosity-driven research. How does the eye regulate the clock? And I should say we know it's the eye because if you cover up the eyes, you can't regulate the clock. And so curiosity-driven research is, and then how does it work and how does it interact with a molecular clock? We've now got, we've been able to translate this knowledge to human health and well-being. And I think that's, it's a great example of serendipity in a sense. We never set out to do that. And yet that's where we've gone with the data.
And how close are we to that drug being used in real world scenarios?
Well, we've got 70% of the money we need to do the full-blown clinical trials. We've already shown it's safe. So what will happen is we'll show efficacy in humans like we've shown in mice. And that will cost about, £5 million, something like that. And everything, drugs, we've got a big international team who've helped us with the design. So we're all ready to go. We just need that last bit of money. And then once we've shown that it works, it would then be taken to a range of different clinical populations. So we'd work on the blind, we'd work on let's say, severe mental illness. And then it's really expensive. It's, you know, full-blown clinical trials. And so what I expect is once we've shown that it works or not, there is a chance, then one of the big pharmaceutical companies will come in, buy it and all the rest of it, and then run with it and spend the tens and sometimes hundreds of millions that it takes to get a drug into the marketplace. But it's fairly close because what this is a repurposed drug, which means that it was already developed for another purpose. In fact, it was developed to try and help with Parkinson's disease. It didn't work. And so it's gone through all of those clinical safety stuff before. And so we know it's safe. And so really, I think I have every confidence that we'll be able to get out there and introduce this drug sooner rather than later. But I would have say within a 5 to 10 year period rather than the sort of 20 to 30 years it takes for some drugs, unless they're sort of fast-tracked.
Again, this whole subject of sleep is underpinned by something that we spoke about at the outset, and that is rhythms. You spoke about something really interesting recently, and I'd like for you to touch upon it now, about outcomes of cancer patients being treated by using standard treatments like radiotherapy and chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Their outcomes depended on the time of day that they were getting those treatments. Can you talk to us about this?
I think that's what's so extraordinary. And we go back quite some years. I mean, there were studies on childhood leukemia, which gave the same drug either in the morning or in the early evening. And they looked at survival rates over, I think it was something like 4 years, 4 to 5 years or so. And those kids that had the evening treatment, death was 70% after 4 or 5 years. Those that had the morning treatment, 70% had died after 4 to 5 years, whereas those that had the evening treatment, 30 to 35% had died. So much greater survival rates on the early evening treatment compared to the morning treatment. And so if we're finding that with a number of other drugs. So ovarian cancer, again, the details are morning versus evening, and I forget which way round it was, but I think that there was 45 to 50% survival in one group, 10% survival in another group. So you can get profound changes depending upon when you give the drug. Now, why is that? Well, of course, the circadian system regulates the cell division cycle. We're all replacing our cells constantly, and that's under the control of a circadian clock. Now, these drugs kill dividing cells, and they don't discriminate at the moment between a cancer cell and a healthy cell. So if you give an anti-cancer drug at a time when, let's say, the liver or the gut or other cells are undergoing cell division, they will be hit very badly. And so you'll weaken the body's ability to defend itself. So we think what's going on is that essentially, if you can give the anti-cancer drugs at a time window when the major organs are not undergoing cell division, you'll increase the health of the individual and you'll kill the cancer cell. And of course, these drugs can be desperately effective, because what cancer cells are doing at all, they've lost their clocks. So they're dividing repeatedly and repeatedly. And that's why a drug that will kill a dividing cell is so effective in cancer. And interestingly enough, some basic science studies have shown that if you put back the clock in a cancer cell, you minimize that unrestricted cell division. So there's some fascinating stuff going on there. Similar results with immunotherapy and radiotherapy. So the timed use of these drugs is extremely important. And that, of course, is true for many other drugs. You know, there's some data out there showing that, of course, our chance of having a stroke is a 50% greater chance of having a stroke between 6 a.m. and 12 noon than any other time of the day. And on the basis of, and that's well documented, everybody agrees to that, 50% greater chance. And so individuals thought, well, hang on, when do we give our antihypertensives? Do we give them in the morning, or do we give them before you go to bed? And of course, you think, well, you give them in the morning. But if you think about the way that drugs work, you get up, you eventually take your drug, the drug then needs to get absorbed and then, you know, be active. And of course, by the time it kicks in, you've passed that 6 a.m. to 12 noon dangerous window. The drug is beginning to kick in when the risk of a stroke is decreasing. And because these drugs hang around in the body for a reasonable length of time, if you take it before you go to bed, the drug is there during that dangerous window, that 6 a.m., 12 noon, you know, spike in blood pressure. And it's there to blunt that spike. And in fact, evening versus morning, taking of antihypertensives in this fairly recent study, halved the death rate over a 10-year period, which is really interesting. So again, time of day. One of the great frustrations, of course, is that this is relatively new science. And in a five-year training, most of our doctors won't be exposed to sleep circadian rhythm. So they won't really know much about this. So what we're trying to do is what we've done is develop a fully online master's degree and diploma for healthcare professionals so they can get up to date with this kind of information. It's all online, so they take it when they need it, and we try and coordinate tutorials when they're free. So we can make sure healthcare professionals know about the importance of timing and the importance of sleep and this whole part of our biology, which is largely ignored in medical practice.
It's extraordinary to think that there's a good biological time and a bad biological time that extends to something like a chronic disease treatment, but also to something as mundane as the cognitive function of students, teenage students in school, yeah, studying maths first thing in the morning, which you've criticized. Yeah. Can you talk to us about this?
It's great. So some lovely studies have worked on adults and shown when is the best time to solve problems, match different shapes, do mathematical tasks. And for adults, it's around about 12 noon, between 11 and 12 noon, maybe a little bit after, but it's around that 12 noon period. So from the moment we wake, our cognitive abilities peak. So, you know, for you and I, decision-making, we should think about making those important decisions late morning, early afternoon. But teenagers are 2 hours shifted. So they're beginning to peak at 2 p.m. And so there's a real tension here because their teachers are coming in and they're, you know, bouncing off the walls or ready to teach those hard subjects like maths and all the rest of it. The kids are still waking up. And then in the early afternoon when the kids are, you know, firing on all cylinders, the teachers are beginning to decline in their cognitive abilities. There's a mismatch there. But the practical result of all that is if you delay exams to the early afternoon, then you see higher test scores and higher pass rates. So it translates to have a real impact. Are we moving those exam scores? Are we moving those exams to later in the day? To my knowledge, not. No. So there is a mismatch. And of course, people sort of often dismiss teenagers as being lazy. But it introduced the concept of a chronotype. Well, you know, are you a lark? Are you a dove in the middle or an owl? And that chronotype is composed of three components. One is our genes. We talked about those clock genes, and they form this molecular feedback loop. And subtle changes in those genes can either speed up or slow down the clock. And so that can contribute to whether you're a lark or an owl. So there's a genetic component. The second is how old we are. So from about the age of 10, there's a tendency to want to go to bed later and later and later. And that peaks in men around about 21, in women about 19, 19 and a half. So women peak earlier than men, and men tend to always be later chronotypes than women. And then from that late teens, early 20s, there's a slow move to want to go to bed slightly earlier and earlier as the years go by. The bottom line is that the time you're in your late 50s, early 60s, you're wanting to go to bed as a 60-year-old 2 hours earlier than you did in your late teens, early 20s. So there's a real difference there in our timing. So there's genes, there's development, and that's almost certainly associated with changes in our hormonal profile, that sharp rise from 10 to the late teens associated with puberty, and then a change in those sex hormones as we decline with age. And then the third component is when we see light. Now, I said that light was critically important. It's detected by those photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, but morning light advances the clock, makes you get up earlier and go to bed earlier. Whereas dusk light delays the clock, makes you want to go to bed later and get up later. Now, when we're all agricultural workers, as we were up until fairly recently, then we got symmetrical exposure to morning and evening light, and we kind of stayed on track. We did a study on university students all over the world a few years ago and showed that those with the latest chronotype, the ones that were most owl-like, were getting no morning light, which would have advanced the clock, but they were out late afternoon, early evening, getting the dusk light, which was delaying the clock. So if you're a late type, you have some ability to sort of nudge your clock forward by setting the alarm. And if you can get outside and it's, you know, you can get light outside, that's great. And if it's dark, then you can sit in front of a light box, get that morning light, and it will nudge you earlier in time, meaning it's going to be easier to get up, in the morning. This is the danger, of course, of people oversleeping hugely at weekends, because you sleep through the morning light for a couple of days. You're not, and you're getting that later, so the clock moves to a later time, which means on Monday, it's going to be much more difficult to get out of bed because the clock has moved a little bit, making it more difficult to, it's moved to a delayed start because you've missed the morning light. So that's why everybody, you know, recommends getting morning light exposure, which is so important, and keeping a regular schedule.
As you mentioned already, everybody has a different chronotype and we're all at different stages in our lives, which dictate when exactly we should be going to bed and getting up, etc. But would you have any advice, any standardized advice for people across the board as to how to optimize the sleep they do get whenever they do get to bed?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, the first thing, you're so right, Matthew, because sleep is like shoe size. You know, one size does not fit all. And so we talked about variability in our chronotype, when we like to go to bed and when we like to get up. Sleep duration also changes how much sleep we need. And, you know, one of the reasons for writing Lifetime was I was fed up with these sort of sergeant majors screaming at us, you must get 8 hours of sleep or you're going to die. You can't do this and all the rest of it. And really, it's about being in tune with what our individual sleep needs are. And, you know, it's not rocket science. if you feel that you're not performing at your peak during the daytime, you're probably not getting the sleep that you need at night. If you oversleep extensively on free days, like weekends, and also particularly when you're on holiday, that really gives you a lot of time to unmask what your sleep patterns really are. If you are dependent upon an alarm clock or somebody else to get you out of bed, if you're not waking naturally from REM sleep and feeling refreshed, if you're sleepy, irritable, and fatigued when you wake up and during the day, this is all telling you you're not getting enough sleep. If you crave a nap during the day, your behavior, we come back to overly impulsive, you're doing stupid, unreflective things. If you're craving caffeinated drinks to keep you going during the day. And it's also important to listen to the people you spend your lives with, your family, your friends, your work colleagues. If they're saying, you know, you seem to be a bit more irritable, you don't have the same empathy, you seem to be a bit disinhibited. This is all telling us that we're not getting the sleep that we need. And of course, there's a lot we can do. And I think this is so important because people tend to think of, you know, the sleep is what you get. And of course it isn't. There's masses we can do about it. And we don't have time to go through all of the strategies, I think, here. But there's a table in Lifetime which actually outlines the key things. And you can do things during the day, before you go to bed, in the bedroom itself, and in bed. And there's lots we can do. But the one thing I would say that's so important, and I think it may be one of the most important, is that most people don't have a sleep issue or a sleep problem. It's an anxiety or a stress problem. And so it's so important to wind down before you go to sleep and you try and get to sleep. And also that you've got, you may need to do mindfulness. You may need to develop some strategy for yourself that means that if you wake up in the middle of the night, it's not necessarily the end of sleep. We talked about, you know, the fact that polyphasic, biphasic sleep is perfectly normal. The key thing is that when you do wake, you think, oh my goodness, that's it, I may as well start doing emails and drinking coffee. You stay calm, you relax, and you will fall back to sleep again. I think it's de-stressing that's so important. And, you know, it may well be a trip to the gym at the end of the day, a swim. it may be, you know, something like that, or winding down before we go to bed, reading a few pages of your favorite novel, listening to some of your relaxing music. There are lots of different strategies that we can use.
An abundance of great advice, and all dispensed in the book, which is called Lifetime. Professor Russell Foster, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
A great pleasure, Matthew.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you enjoyed it, or indeed any of the previous almost 400 episodes at this stage, please show your support, like, subscribe, share with other people you think might get value and enjoy this content too, and do leave the podcast a positive rating. Until next time, stay happy.